Today is Tuesday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
But if we had proper border security, including a very powerful wall, we wouldn't have to work so hard. And it would be a lot safer and a lot better.
Also ahead, a newly elected U.S. Congresswoman who is a Somali refugee has apologized for comments she made criticizing a pro-Israeli group, and the attempt by a Thai princess to enter politics has increased political tensions in Thailand. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. congressional negotiators have reached a deal in principle to fund the government and avoid another government shutdown at the end of the week. The bipartisan group has not made the details public, but congressional aides say the agreement includes about $1.4 billion to build 88 kilometers of new fencing at the U.S.-Mexico border. It would also add technology upgrades for screening at border entry points, as well as more customs officers and humanitarian aid. And for more insight into the deal, we have VOA congressional correspondent in the studio with us, Catherine Gibson. And thanks for joining us, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
So really, how was this deal made? How did it come about?
This deal came about because we are really running out of time here in Washington, D.C. Congressional negotiators were not even set to meet Monday afternoon. And then they had a series of last-minute meetings as President Trump was headed to El Paso for a rally at the border. They came up with this deal, which, as you mentioned, is, of course, in principle, not in writing yet. There are a lot of details still to be hammered out. In hearing from congressional lawmakers this morning on the U.S. Senate side, some of them, notably Republican Lindsey Graham, were saying that these details are not ones that the president could sign off on. And we know we haven't heard from him yet. So that's a big, big unknown in all of this so far.
Yes. And actually, I was going to ask you about support. Does the president have a lot of support so far for this in-principle deal?
Well, we're waiting to hear from him. We're waiting to hear whether he'll accept that significant reduction in border wall funding. We know that's something that he's been promising since the very beginning of his campaign. And so in order to sign off on this deal, he would have to go back on that. He does have a couple of backup options at his disposal if he wants to get that increased funding. The National Emergency Declaration is still on the table, as well as, you know, moving around some of those funds so that he could just go ahead and build the wall.
Now, he was in El Paso yesterday, so how did that go when he was there?
Well, it was very interesting to watch that rally because it was just as congressional negotiators were announcing the outlines of this deal. The president himself said that he didn't want to be briefed on the details of it because he had to go to this rally. And of course, you know, he made his usual promises that we've heard throughout that 35-day government shutdown that no matter what, this wall is going to be built.
And how assured are federal government workers, or can they be assured that the government will not shut down on Friday?
I think government workers have learned from the longest government shutdown in U.S. history that we just saw that nothing is for certain until the very last moment when the ink is drying on that deal.
So do you think that he will sign something this week?
I think that he will, just because the optics of that previous shutdown were so bad. Those images of federal workers waiting in line for free food, the air traffic snarled at LaGuardia, one of the nation's major airports. I don't think that Republicans want to let the president go back to those bad optics.
And also, what is in store once he does sign it? Does that mean that maybe he's really not going to get what he really wants in terms of the wall?
Well, it's really interesting as to whether or not he'll make that national emergency declaration, because, of course, that's still on the table. It's something that he threatens on a regular basis. But I think the president and his White House advisors also know that if they did go down that route, it would immediately be challenged in the courts. They would be snarled in legal battles about whether a president has the authority to make that move, and it would be another headache on his plate.
Well, I guess from a executive level, does he does have the authority to do it. It's just a matter of, I guess, him actually doing it?
The sense from some congressional Republicans is that he does have the authority to do it. And of course, we know there's a couple dozen national emergencies that have been declared that we're currently under. The question is whether the border wall, the so-called border crisis that Trump likes to talk about, really truly qualifies as a national emergency. And that's the issue that will get him tripped up in the courts.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Catherine, for the insight into this, I guess, ongoing deal we have here this week. And that's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson here in the studio with me. Well, a newly elected U.S. Congresswoman who is a Somali refugee has apologized for comments she made criticizing a pro-Israeli group. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota posted a series of comments on Twitter accusing the American-Israeli lobbying group known as AIPAC of paying lawmakers to support Israel. The group does not contribute to political campaign funds. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Omar to apologize after widespread criticisms of her remarks. Later, Omar said she believed anti-Semitism was real and that she did not intend to offend Jewish Americans. The American Jewish Committee called Omar's tweets about AIPAC demonstrably false and anti-Semitic. President Donald Trump, on his way to an event in El Paso, Texas, said her apology was not adequate. Among some of the top stories making a global headlines are some Italian commentators and industrialists warn the feuding between Italy and France, driven by internal political dynamics on both sides of the Alps, risks boiling over into the economic sphere. The UN Refugee Agency says a surge of violence in South Sudan's Equatorial State has displaced some 8,000 civilians and sent an estimated 5,000 people fleeing to the neighboring DRC. U.S.-backed forces are closing in on Islamic State fighters in their last stronghold in eastern Syria, and China says it will fund installation of modern facilities at the Pakistan-Afghan border gates. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today said the U.S. has been a friend to Slovakia since the end of the Cold War and pledged continued U.S. support. He offered similar warm words for Hungary yesterday. He lamented what he called the U.S. absence from Central Europe, which he said had allowed Russia and China to fill the vacuum. However, analysts say there are tensions in the relationships. The U.S. has pledged support for anti-corruption initiatives and independent media in Hungary. Some critics and other NATO allies worry Budapest is too close to Russia. Pompeo also criticized Hungary's ties with Chinese telecommunications company Huawei, which the U.S. says could be involved in Chinese state espionage. China has denied that allegation. The Tech Secretary of State was in Slovakia on the second leg of a five-nation European trip. He next travels to Poland for a two-day summit on the Middle East, where Iran will be the focus of talks. Well, the Wall Street Journal recently reported the U.S.-allied Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, has been selling oil from fields that it controls in the east of Syria, despite U.S. economic sanctions. The Syrian government and the Kurds have been discussing possible autonomy conditions in light of the expected U.S. pullout from the north of the country, and Arab media report that oil resources are one of the main topics of negotiation. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media reports say Kurdish negotiators from the U.S.-allied SDF in the north of Syria and Syrian government officials, including intelligence chief Ali Mamluk, have been holding autonomy talks since mid-January in Damascus and at the Russian Humaymim Air Base in Latakia. The Syrian government is reportedly discussing control of oil fields in the northeast of the country, now under Kurdish control, along with Kurdish demands to continue an education program in Kurdish, which Damascus rejects. The U.S. Daily Wall Street Journal reported Friday the Syrian-owned Khatirji Group is purchasing oil from the SDF and refining it for use in areas of the country that it controls. The head of the group was recently placed under U.S. economic sanctions. University of Paris professor Khatar Abu Diab tells VOA he thinks the oil sales are mostly black market deals, and the Islamic State group had also sold oil from the same fields to the Syrian government when they controlled them.
The force American vont accomplir la retraite de 6 avril.
He says U.S. forces are planning to complete their withdrawal by April, and that all parties are preparing for that moment in order to fill the void to the east of the Euphrates River. In this race against the clock, he stresses, Turkey is negotiating with both the United States and Russia, while the Kurds are negotiating with the United States and the Syrian government. American University of Beirut political science professor Hilal Kashan says the parties in the Syrian conflict are involved in pragmatic business dealings rather than issues of morality.
The war in Syria is a war by proxy, and everybody is there is fighting on behalf of somebody else. The Kurds need cash. If they don't get it from the Syrian government through the sale of oil, then they might be asking the U.S. for the money. So I don't see any ideological issue for the U.S. After all, politics is about pragmatism. These people are selling oil. If Assad doesn't get oil from the Kurds, he will get it from another source.
Lebanese economist and former finance minister George Korm tells VOA he believes the Kurds in the north of Syria have an interest in establishing a constructive dialogue with the Syrian government, given the threats by Turkish President Erdogan to set up a security zone in northern Syria. He says Syria is being aided by powerful countries with economic resources like China, Russia, and Iran, so he does not think U.S. economic sanctions will have a major effect on the Syrian government. He also argues the Syrian economy has traditionally been self-sufficient, so it is less dependent on outside forces. Arab media, however, reported in recent weeks the Syrian currency has lost more of its value to the dollar, currently trading on the black market at between 600 and 700 Syrian lira to the dollar, causing increasing economic hardships for many people. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Thank you, Edward. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, South Korea and the U.S. struck a new deal on Sunday that increases Seoul's contribution for the cost of the American military presence on its soil, overcoming previous failed negotiations that caused worries about the decades-long alliance. For more on the agreement, VOA's Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Bruce Bennett, a senior international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation, who was currently at the U.S. Army's Camp Humphreys in South Korea.
Well, I think it was very important to conclude it as rapidly as possible. The growing debate over the so-called burden-sharing amount was causing a fair amount of concern in Korea about whether the United States would pull troops out or do other things that would not be good for the alliance. So the fact that this has gotten resolved relatively quickly after the commitment for the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un, I think that's very healthy, and unfortunately, we're going to be back to the bargaining table very soon.
Now, does that open a deal, one might say, between Trump and Kim when they meet in Hanoi?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, we don't know what exactly President Trump is thinking. The thing, though, that needs to be emphasized here is while the South Korean National Assembly's got to approve this deal, they aren't going to increase the defense budget to pay the extra amount of money. The bottom line is that's going to have to come out of something in a fixed defense budget.
Can you ascertain what the feeling of the Korean public is about this?
I've just been in Korea just under one day. So my sense, though, from media depictions and from other things, people are glad this debate is over. They wanted it to not be a big issue. They wanted to make sure that this was not going to hurt the alliance. And so I think people are going to be very happy, but worried still about the future.
Do you expect this to have any effect whatsoever on the upcoming summit meeting?
Well, I think Kim Jong-un's going to be disappointed. He was very hopeful that this split in perspectives was going to really injure the alliance. So I think he's going to be disappointed that the U.S. and South Korea were able to compromise and put the importance of the alliance ahead of this monetary issue. I think he's still going to likely press President Trump to withdraw some number of American troops in exchange for something on his side.
Do you think that the meeting is advisable?
Oh, I think it's advisable. I mean, the president, when you deal with people in Asia, there are two dimensions of any negotiation. The first is the personal dimension. And President Trump had good results on the personal dimension with the first summit and since then, but he's got to re-energize that. So that's important. The second dimension is the substance. And that's where we're not sure whether Kim is prepared to give anything. If he's not, then there may not be a whole lot of reason for further negotiation and further interaction. The U.S. may just need to turn up the pressure. So this is a difficult time in terms of trying to see both what Kim Jong-un is going to do and what President Trump is going to do.
That was VOA's Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Bruce Bennett, a senior international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation at Camp Humphreys, a U.S. Army base in South Korea. Well, at least 17 people have died in a fire that destroyed a low-cost hotel in Delhi, India today. The fire is the latest deadly incident that has raised safety concerns in the country. The fire broke out at the Hotel Arpit Palace in a busy area in central Delhi. Local media report that a woman and a child who tried to escape by jumping from a window were among the dead. A Delhi fire official said 35 people were rescued in the operation that took several hours. Activists say builders often put up unsafe structures to save cost. They blame local officials for not enforcing safety standards. Well, the attempt by Prince's Ubonrat Manidhan to enter politics has increased political tensions in Thailand. The prince is registered to become a candidate for prime minister in the March 24th elections. However, her brother, Maha Wanjiranakorn, called the move highly inappropriate and unconstitutional soon after. Yesterday, the Thai Election Commission ruled out her candidacy. The move proved especially divisive because the prince is registered with a party close to exiled former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. Thaksin was ousted by the military in 2006. Rules bar the royal family from direct involvement in party politics. However, the princess said she believed she was exempt because she had given up her royal title in 1972. Royalists were highly displeased with the princess's involvement with a party linked to Thaksin. The two sides have been bitterly fighting for the last 20 years. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo. Coming up on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, a discussion on vaccines and the so-called vaccination resistance movement. Our program will feature conversations with medical doctor and vaccinologist Dr. Peter Hotez and Christina Hildebrand, founder of an organization that advocates for vaccine and pharmaceutical product choice. Listen this Saturday and Sunday for the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigeria's presidential election is set for February 16th. President Muhammadu Buhari of the APC and top challenger Atiku Abubakar of the PDPs are both Fulani Muslims. A discussion on what's at stake on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Thousands of Haitians protested in the streets of Port-au-Prince yesterday, calling for President Jovenel Moïse to resign. Police used tear gas to break up crowds of demonstrators who carried banners and burned tires in the streets. Unrest in the Caribbean island nation has grown as inflation and accusations of corruption increase. Protesters accuse the government of misusing $3.8 billion in connection with an oil deal signed with Venezuela. The Petro-Caribbean deal started in June 2005. It was to provide money for social and economic projects. A group of opposition lawmakers also is calling on Moise to resign. They are demanding that he be replaced with a transitional government that would work to improve living conditions. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, while people are working out at their gym, dogs are getting their own exercise at a sports club just for canines. While unconventional, the gym offers pet parents a place where their pup can stay fit and have fun at the same time. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to Frolic Dogs in Alexandria, Virginia, which is among the canine sports clubs that have been popping up across the U.S.
This 5-year-old Visla named Stella is a regular at Frolic Dogs, a canine sports club in Alexandria, Virginia.
She's so active, and so I see how happy she is when we're at the gym and she's playing and she's able to, you know, jump through the hoop or go up on the balance beam, and she's very proud of herself, which of course then makes me happy.
Dog lovers Kim Gilliam and her husband opened the first canine gym in the Washington, D.C. area 4 years ago.
We definitely got some eye rolls and some scratching heads when we told them, we were opening a dog gym. But once you come in and you really see how people are working with their dogs, bonding with their dogs, and also getting them that exercise that they so badly need, it really does make sense.
This pudgy dog named Ziggy was brought to the sports club for the first time to get a workout.
He tried. He did.
It is the new year, so I think everybody's getting in the gym and just trying to, you know, lose some extra pounds.
Like a human sports club, the dog owners can pay a fee each time they come or get a monthly membership. Besides keeping fit, the workout also helps keep the dog stimulated and reinforces good behavior.
Good boy. Love seeing him jump around and play with the other dogs here and see what all the other dogs can do, so then we can learn from that.
The gym also helped Poodle Mix Scooter, who was found as a stray living on the streets.
When I first got him, he spent the first year of agility class hiding under chairs. He was terrified of everything. We worked with him, and he is now a pretty outgoing little guy.
Good boy.
This 5-year-old German Shepherd is staying fit after taking part in hundreds of local agility competitions.
He takes first place a lot of times. Quite often he beats dogs that are well above him in the levels.
Gilliam says the pet parents get a workout too by running around with their pup.
I've had some folks tell me they're just as tired as their dog when they leave.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Well, 58 years ago today, on February 12th, in 1961, this song that's coming up, Shop Around by the Miracles, became Motown Records' first million-selling single. Well, the group didn't stop there. In the 10 years that followed, they had 6 more million-dollar hits.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
That's the Miracles with Shop Around. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Thank you.
is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.